Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how did the American media system become what it is today? And how have First Amendment rights changed? We'll trace the history in the debates that shaped it. But first, we continue with Archie Brown about what kinds of political leadership work best for societies. This is part two of that discussion. Strong leaders are not necessarily good for societies, or so our next guest says. Archie Brown's comprehensive study on leadership suggests that so-called strong leaders make catastrophic mistakes that tend to cost lives. Archie Brown is professor emeritus at Oxford University, and his latest book is called The Myth of the Strong Leader, Political Leadership in the Modern Age. Welcome, Archie Brown. It's great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
It seems like in democracies, you have more of the category of redefining leaders. You have quite a few examples of those. Let's talk about them.
Yes, I mean, in transformational leaders, I think it's easier to find them in authoritarian regimes, people like Gorbachev, who transformed the Soviet political system, or Deng Xiaoping, who played the leading role in transforming the Chinese economic system. But in a democracy, yes, there are people who I think can fairly be called redefining leaders. They redefine what's possible within their country. They move the center in their direction rather than simply seeking out the center ground and planting themselves firmly within it. They move the center to the left or to the right. But in any case, they change understanding of what is possible within that country. And the two examples I pick out in the United States are Franklin D. Roosevelt, not surprisingly, with the New Deal, which introduced more governmental intervention in the American economy than was normally thought to be decent in the United States, and Lyndon Johnson for his civil rights legislation and war on poverty. He fared disastrously in foreign policy with the Vietnam War, but in domestic policy, he really was a redefining leader, and some of what he achieved has been of lasting significance, especially widening the suffrage to people who had been unfairly denied the vote in many southern states.
You pointed out aptly that Americans in particular expect too much from the president.
I think it is that in the United States there are tremendous expectations of the president, and you know, given the constraints on the president from things I mentioned, the Congress, judiciary, the lobbies, then it's quite unrealistic. And I think expectations were especially high in the case of Barack Obama because he was such a brilliant campaigner. And he really did inspire a lot of people on his way to the White House in the first place. But then he inherited a very difficult situation abroad, especially in the Middle East. And relations with Russia, of course, have been difficult. And that's partly because of the way internal developments in Russia have gone. It would have been difficult for any president to establish good relations with Putin's Russia. And then domestically, a full-blown economic crisis. So the expectations, I think, especially in retrospect, were unrealistically great.
Where would you put Ronald Reagan?
Well, Ronald Reagan, I think, was not really a redefining leader. He certainly was successful in the sense that he made people feel better about America again. His sunny optimism definitely struck a chord with many Americans. He was very lucky in the fact that Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union in March 1985, because we tend to forget that there were four Soviet leaders who overlapped with Reagan: Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko, then Gorbachev. And absolutely nothing changed for the better in East-West relations or in Eastern Europe or in the Soviet Union during the leadership of those first three. So, you know, it was the Gorbachev coming to power that was decisive for the change in Soviet foreign policy and, you know, ultimately the whole of Eastern Europe becoming non-communist and independent. So I think, you know, Ronald Reagan has been a lucky president. He gets a lot of credit for the end of the Cold War, and he did play a role, but his role was secondary to that played by Gorbachev.
I think within the domestic setting, he successfully changed the attitude of the country to his ideology, which was more anti-government, more pro-business, which has maybe now spiraled out of control, it seems. And even though he himself did not reduce the spending, he has created the demand for that within the American public.
Yes, I think he did affect people's attitudes to private-public arrangements, and just as Margaret Thatcher did in Britain. But, you know, in principle, he was against big government. But, in fact, government spending increased enormously under Ronald Reagan, not least because of the military budget. And so he left a bigger deficit than he inherited. And, you know, this is forgotten. There was a gap between the rhetoric and the reality.
You also have South Africa in your book. And you had, of course, Nelson Mandela as transformational and F.W. de Klerk as maybe redefining.
I think de Klerk does deserve some credit for realizing that the apartheid regime couldn't go on as it had done. Again, the changes in the Soviet Union were relevant because the card that the supporters of apartheid had kept playing in South Africa was the fear of communism. And the African National Congress, you know, included many communists, others who were sympathetic to the Communist Party. So as long as there was a Soviet Union there and they could be portrayed as somehow being allies of the Soviet Union, then there were people in the outside world who were prepared to tolerate the apartheid regime. But with the changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe becoming non-communist, he couldn't play the anti-communist card any longer. And the support both within South Africa from the overwhelmingly larger black population and from outside was becoming ever more pressing. So he recognized that and made overtures to Nelson Mandela. But Mandela was the transformational leader, because insofar as South Africa has made a peaceful transition, relatively peaceful transition, from minority white rule to majority rule, it was through Mandela's extraordinary magnanimity and his inclusive style. And, you know, he finished up with something inconceivable, the Afrikaner population admiring him, not just respecting him, but, you know, even loving him. So that was quite remarkable. And he also served only one term as president. In a continent with far too many presidents for life, you know, he had the good sense to stand down after one term as president.
And you talked about the Brazilian leader, Fernando Henrique Cardoso. What about him?
Cardoso, again, I think, was a remarkable leader. I mean, probably transformational, at least redefining, that, you know, he really established democracy on a firm foundation in Brazil. And again, he was inclusive. He got the trade unions on his side in order to curb inflation and persuaded them that, you know, high inflation was not in the interests of workers. So I think, you know, both in terms of democracy building and in terms of his economic policy, he was a remarkable leader.
What about Taiwan?
Taiwan is an interesting case. Because, you know, Chiang Kai-shek's son was the person who really laid the groundwork for democracy. Again, there were external influences. The fact that the United States was beginning to improve relations with communist China made him realize that Taiwan's position was going to be stronger in the outside world if it became more democratic. And so he instituted democratic reforms.
When we look through all of these leaders, and we think about what kind of leaders we want. You used a quote from Lao Tzu that leadership is best when we barely know that the leader is there. Do you think that's true?
It's an interesting statement. I think it's sometimes the case that when a leader has quite a low profile but still, you know, achieves things through others, that's in a very fine kind of leadership. But at other times, you know, you do have to see the leader playing a more prominent role. But on the whole, I think, you know, we go to the other extreme. We obsess about the individual leader. I mean, in Britain, you know, all the time people are writing about the political divide in terms of Cameron and Miliband, and far too much attention paid to those two individuals. The more you expect one individual to do, whether leader of a party or not, you know, the less time that individual has to focus on each of the issues. And so it's really a huge mistake to try to pile more and more on their agenda and ask them to decide. So I much prefer the Clement Attlee style of leadership, in which ministers had tremendous authority within their own departments, but on really big issues of principle, they had to get the agreement of the collective, of the cabinet, and Attlee presided over that cabinet, but didn't try to thrust his opinion down the throats of his colleagues. That, for me, is a better style of leadership.
On the U.S. side of that, you pointed out that Truman was a bit that way.
Yes, I think Harry Truman, one couldn't say he was a redefining leader, or still less a transformational leader, but he was an effective leader. And I think there's no doubt that the greatest achievement of the Truman administration was the Marshall Plan. I mean, that really was responsible probably for saving democracy in Europe, not only saving it from economic collapse, but, you know, at a time when communist regimes were rising in Europe, it also underpinned democracy. And the prime mover was, of course, Secretary of State George Marshall. But, you know, Truman was happy for Marshall to take most of the credit. And another leader might have wanted to call it the Truman Plan. I know there was a Truman Doctrine, but the Truman Doctrine wasn't as important as the Marshall Plan. That was undoubtedly the greatest achievement of his administration. And it's quite right, and Truman was suitably modest in accepting that it should bear the name of Secretary of State Marshall.
You pointed out that he was also a very reluctant leader, and that this is something that our Greek philosophers have pointed out that perhaps should be one of the defining characteristics of a good leader.
Yes, when somebody said to him that he'd shown he would rather be right than president, he said he would rather be anything than president. That's pretty unusual for somebody who becomes to the top in any political system. But it may not be such a bad characteristic. In Britain, recently there was pressure for a minister who resigned, Alan Johnson, who has written a very good book about his poverty-stricken childhood, to become leader of the Labour Party, and he said he wouldn't, under any circumstances, stand for election as leader of the Labour Party. So one or two people wrote letters to newspapers saying, well, this is exactly the kind of leader we need, somebody who doesn't want to be leader. So there is something to be said for it. But I think, on the whole, even though I take the line I do, I think it would be going too far to say that modesty must be a characteristic of a head of government.
What are the other characteristics that you think we need in a good leader?
Well, the ones I pick out are integrity, intelligence, collegiality, shrewd judgment, a questioning mind, willingness to seek alternative views, ability to absorb information, if we're lucky, vision, courage, flexibility, good memory, articulateness, empathy, great energy. That's quite a list, and we wouldn't expect any individual leader to incorporate all of them.
It does seem that we expect them to incorporate all of them and to be strong when they have to be strong, too. Do you think we expect too much?
I think we do expect too much, and I think that, you know, we should be beyond the stage where we look to a chief, you know, as if we're a primitive tribe. We need to a chief to tell us what to do. We should, you know, be more willing to spread the load and for individuals within a leadership to exercise their own leadership and not look just to one person at the top. It seems to me to be neither sensible nor appropriate within a democracy.
The other thing I wonder sometimes when I think about this focus on individual leaders is that we don't really focus enough on processes, systems, institutions, social forces, and trying to understand why things are the way they are. Would you think that's accurate?
Well, this is certainly true that, you know, part of the obsession with leadership is an obscuring of the social forces you mentioned. I mean, the power of money in American politics and American elections is unusually great, and certainly one could argue that it's inappropriately great for a democracy. So, you know, simply obsessing about, you know, whether A or B will be the next president may be obscuring more fundamental issues.
A characteristic that you wrote about that maybe a leader should not have is hubris.
Yes. I mean, the longer they remain in office, the more inclined they are to think that they're always right. And, you know, when Margaret Thatcher died, people said, well, she was a conviction politician. But one of her convictions was that she was always right. And, you know, eventually her colleagues got fed up with that, and her own cabinet turned against her and told her she couldn't go on. It happened to Tony Blair as well. So the United States may well be right in restricting presidents to two terms of office. In a parliamentary system, you can normally go on longer than that if your colleagues will put up with you, and the electorate will as well. But there is a real danger for politicians who stay in office too long. Greater, of course, in authoritarian regimes where people are even more deferential to the leader and they're afraid of the leader very often because the leader has such control over their lives that then they, too, suffer from hubris.
Where did you think the President George W. Bush belonged?
Well, President George W. Bush was certainly not a redefining leader. And I would argue he was rather an unsuccessful leader. He certainly didn't meet a number of the criteria which I mentioned, which would include, you know, high intelligence, articulateness, and so on. And he made a monumental mistake, in my view, at the time of the Iraq War. he probably, being inexperienced in foreign policy, listened too much to some of the people in his entourage. So in that sense, he wasn't an especially strong leader, though he makes a great point in his memoirs about how he was the decider. Well, perhaps he took the ultimate decision, but a lot of the groundwork pointed in a particular direction, and that was the direction of military intervention in Iraq. And it's very easy to destabilize a country if you use America's vast military power. It's very much harder to control what the subsequent repercussions will be.
When you looked over the course of the 20th century, which was the focus of this book that you have just published, have you noticed patterns in terms of how leadership has changed over that century and into the 21st century?
Well, one of the most important changes is, of course, the advent of television and now all the social media. But it is the case that a leader who is hopeless on television is unlikely to do very well now in a democracy. So you really need to add that to the list of attributes that a leader has to have, that he can be reasonably persuasive and presentable on TV. And, you know, the 24/7 media means that the extent to which the leader is under constant examination is far greater. You know, when Stanley Baldwin was British Prime Minister, he got into, this is in the 1930s, he got into a railway carriage, and somebody who had been at school with him asked him what he was doing now. And you know, his photograph was occasionally in the papers, but there was no TV. And so if somebody was inattentive to politics, they could be unaware that the person was Prime Minister. So that's a big change. And then some people say Attlee, the post-war Labour government, the Labour Prime Minister, could not have been so successful today because he was somebody who would never use two words when one would do, and he might not have come over so well on TV. I don't know, but that's certainly a change. The mass media have affected the way in which leaders are perceived, and they've also personalized it even more than it was before, and they've focused increasingly on the person of the top leader rather than the team.
The other aspect of leadership that you point out is how we tend to evaluate them. You warn against this sort of dichotomies when we're thinking about leaders. They're good, they're bad, they're strong, they're weak, that there is this oversimplification on our part. What is the cost of this oversimplification, and how can we adjust our thinking?
Well, I think, you know, these dichotomies are terribly misleading, and especially the strong, weak one, because it leads a leader to want to show that he's strong and or she's strong, and instead of considering the policy in the round and bringing all your colleagues and acting collegially, you've got to demonstrate strength. That tends to mean then that you take policy decisions yourself and then may exclude people who should be involved in them because you're wanting to show how strong you are. So I think that strong, weak way of judging leaders is especially dangerous. But, you know, leadership is a complicated thing, and it depends on the context, and foreign policy and economic policy can be leading in different directions. A leader should simply not try to hoard power and do everything himself or herself. I mean, Margaret Thatcher once in the cabinet said, "Why do I have to do everything myself in this government?" Well, of course, she didn't need to. There were perfectly capable people around the table, but she'd come to believe that she had to.
The other aspect, I think, of this media age that you pointed out is this sort of cult of personality that has emerged, where it's just blinded to everything except for this very monolithic view of a leader.
Yes, I'm very much against this cult of personality in democracies, as well as still more obviously in authoritarian regimes. Now, Adlai Stevenson once said, the way things are going, you know, we'll finish up with an actor as president. Well, not very long after they had an actor as president, and he wasn't exactly a failure either. But the cult of personality, I think, is damaging for democratic politics. In a democracy, we should believe that people as a whole have a right to influence decisions, and there should be a group of people in government who share power. The idea that one person knows best, I mean, that should have died out with the divine right of kings.
So in the end, after doing this analysis over all the years that you have done this analysis, in the grand scheme of things, given institutions and given processes and routines and all of these forces that make governance work, How important is the head of government leader?
Well, there's no getting away from the fact that the head of government matters. The head of government sets the tone of the government, even if they don't do everything themselves or try to do everything themselves, and they certainly shouldn't. They're bound to be very influential in setting the tone. And so, you know, the difference between an Attlee and a Thatcher in Britain, or the difference between a Reagan and a Johnson. I mean, Reagan was hands-off to a remarkable extent. Johnson was very much hands-on. So, yes, there's no getting away from the fact that a leader is important, and still more in the United States in the sense that the president is the executive in a way in which a prime minister in a European democracy is not. All executive power is not vested in the prime minister. But then against that, of course, you've got the countervailing powers in the United States. I know, I certainly wouldn't wish to deny that the head of government is a very important person.
Archie Brown, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure.
The book again is called The Myth of the Strong Leader. When we come back, how did the American media system become what it is today? Stay tuned.
We want to see our world in one piece.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest traces the history of American media, particularly in the crucial period of the 1940s and 1950s, when citizens and political leaders held vigorous debates about how media could best serve the public. What happened to lead us to where we are today? We're joined by Victor Picard. He's a professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication, the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, and co-author of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? Welcome, Victor Picard. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks for having me on the show, Maria.
Terrific book about how we got here to the current media environment in the USA, but also seems to be followed by other countries. So we're taught that it is objective. You argue that the subjectivity has a purpose in itself. It's not value-free. How would you describe this, and how did it come about?
This notion that the news should remain objective, the objectivity norm, is kind of exhibit A for the professionalization of the press, the American press in particular, because this is a kind of an American-specific norm. I don't think it necessarily translates to other media systems. But what I try to show in my book is that in many ways this presumably value-free media, news media system, is actually shot through with commercial values, that it actually is biased in a particular way, in a structural way, and to understand that you need to look at how our media system is designed and the commercial imperatives that drive it.
How did this come about? You focus on the 1940s as the significant period. What was happening then?
So in the 1940s, you might say then as now, there was a raging policy battle over the nature of the media system, which in the 40s was primarily radio. I also talk a lot about print media and newspapers as well. But there was a lot of concern about what the role of radio should be in a democratic society. A lot of people at that time were concerned that radio was not living up to its democratic promise. Much of the rhetoric that you heard then, similar to what you hear today about the internet, this new media was supposed to democratize society. It was supposed to revolutionize the way we talk about important social issues. And in many ways, it simply wasn't living up to those expectations. So you saw a period where various constituencies, but also just the public writ large, were concerned about the direction of radio, and they were basically trying to intervene in different ways to reshape the system.
that was the time when, say, the FCC was formed, and there were some antitrust rulings, there was some discussion about public service responsibilities. Let's discuss some of these, maybe starting with the FCC, the Communications Commission, how it came about, and what its mission was at that time.
So the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, which is the main regulatory body that has oversight over much of our media system, particularly broadcast media and telecommunications, it was founded with the 1934 Communications Act. And even though it started during the New Deal era, it initially began with somewhat of a backwater agency. It wasn't very ambitious or aggressive in regulating those industries under its purview, although there was a somewhat aggressive study of AT&T in the late 1930s. But it wasn't until the early 40s, late 30s, but especially early 40s, with the arrival of James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly, who was this tough liberal from Texas who was a veteran of a lot of anti-monopoly battles throughout the 30s. And one of the first things that he did when he became chairman of the FCC was start to go after these radio monopolies, especially NBC. It's difficult to imagine this happening today, but Larry Fly essentially trust-busted NBC, or at least he forced NBC to divest itself of one of its major networks, which is actually how we got ABC. So they were very aggressive. It would be like Tom Wheeler today breaking up Verizon or Comcast. It's really kind of beyond our comprehension, but it was something that the FCC was doing in the 40s. They were also preventing newspapers from rapidly buying up radio stations. And as you noted, they eventually pivoted to focus on public service responsibilities as well.
And how has it evolved now, the FCC? How would you say from that point it's become what it is today?
There's a long history there. One thing that was unique to the 1940s was that you had this very rare progressive bloc on the commission. At that time, there were seven commissioners instead of the five that you have today. And four of the seven were at least liberal-leaning. And I don't think you've really had that configuration again since that time. So that's one major difference. I chart this in my book, the long history of the FCC, and there were moments where there were individuals, most recently you had Michael Copps at the FCC, who were able to advance progressive initiatives here and there, but never able to really push forward like they were in the 40s. And some people would argue today, that economists refer to this as regulatory capture, this notion of when regulatory bodies essentially internalize the value systems and the logics of the industries that they're meant to regulate. And some people would say that our current FCC qualifies or at least suffers from some degree of regulatory capture. Just to give one example, people hear about the revolving door phenomenon, and one study shows that since 1980, 20 of the 26 former commissioners and chairs of the FCC have gone to work for the industries that they previously regulated. So I think that's one indication that there's a very cozy relationship now between regulators and industry.
And it seems to have become considerably weaker since this time when there was some trust busting going on.
Absolutely, especially in terms of public interest obligations. One major initiative that many people have at least probably heard of that came out of the 40s was the Fairness Doctrine. This is the last big policy battle of that decade. And there's a bit of historical irony involved because today, at least among progressives, the Fairness Doctrine is often held up as this pinnacle of enlightened media policy. But in the 40s, it was anything but. It was seen as a kind of derivative consolation prize for stronger regulations that the Fairness Doctrine had replaced. And even though from that point forward, at least for the ensuing decades until 1987, when Ronald Reagan's FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine, it was used to varying degrees of success by activists on the left and the right. But in many ways, it was treating the symptoms of bigger fundamental problems with our commercial media system. So I think that's one example where there's been this gradual erosion from structural reform efforts.
The Fairness Doctrine actually had a predecessor. What was that called?
Yes, it replaced the all but forgotten Mayflower Doctrine, and that was something that was implemented in 1941 under Larry Fly when he was still the chairman at the FCC, and it basically prohibited broadcasters from politically editorializing, which sounds quite severe, but at the time it was assumed that since you were, especially in the early 40s, you're really talking about a duopoly. CBS and NBC were the two largest players. They dominated a disproportionate amount of the, and I should underscore this, the public airwaves. And so it was assumed to give them the kind of political power that they would have if they were to editorialize was simply dangerous to have in a democratic society. That was one of the stronger regulations that they were preventing, but that the Fairness Doctrine replaced, but also just this idea that you need to break up the ownership of media, that you shouldn't have concentrated control. I think that's something that was being eroded throughout the 40s and really for the last 60 or 70 years in terms of regulatory reform.
During this time, you had noted this rich flow of ideas, but at a certain point, it seems from your book that the window closed and reform was off limits. What, in your assessment, closed that window?
This period in the 40s, historians sometimes refer to these moments as critical junctures, and they tend to happen when there's political, social, and technological change all happening simultaneously. What you were seeing, and of course a number of things were happening in the 40s, you had World War II, it was a major event, you had the New Deal agenda, which even though it was in various degrees of retreat throughout much of government, social movements at that time in the 40s hadn't gotten the memo that the period of reform had closed, and actually you saw a spike in various forms of activism, especially around civil rights and around labor-related activism. Unions were really on the march at this time. These activist groups realized that they needed to change the media system, and in order to change the system, they really had to change media policy itself. So I think these were some of the elements. You also had the rise of FM radio. This is this kind of technological change happening. And you also just had widespread, at least in varying degrees, you had public disgust towards what was happening with commercial radio, especially the proliferation of radio advertisements, which many people were upset about.
Now, also at this time, the Supreme Court's decisions around free speech, free press, First Amendment were understood not just as the media's right, but as a right to information on the citizen side. How did this then become understood as sort of the privilege of just the media, and particularly the corporate media?
Yes, this was a major battle happening at this time. And really, there was this kind of ideological consolidation, what I refer to as corporate libertarianism, that redefined or at least shifted the understanding. I think it was a little bit up in the air at this point in the 40s about how the First Amendment should be understood with regards to our media. And what came out of this decade was this assumption that corporations in general, but media corporations specifically, have individual rights. They have First Amendment rights, and that their First Amendment rights trump the rights of others, including local communities, various groups, and society writ large. And I think that you see this being fought out in a number of debates. In many ways, they were able to prevail. Certainly, this logic, this corporate libertarian logic, triumphed. But as you noted, there were also Supreme Court decisions that were pushing in the opposite direction, that were saying that it's the rights of the audience, of the public, that are paramount, more sort of these collective First Amendment rights, also these kind of positive freedoms, freedoms of access, for example. So you're really seeing these oppositional views fighting it out throughout the 40s. But I think we inherited the libertarian view, and that's one that we're still grappling with today.
And at the same time, you noted that this was when it also became incorporated into the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it was adopted with the wider meaning rather than just the libertarian meaning.
That's right. So one way of understanding this is positive versus negative rights, and the idea that negative rights are protecting us from things. Usually it's assumed, at least in the United States context, that it's protecting us from government. But there's also these positive rights, freedom to or freedom for. And to use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as an example, Article 19 really enshrines some of these positive rights, what are sometimes referred to as communication rights or the right to communicate. I do think it is this more social democratic vision that you see glimmers of throughout the 1940s. It's an alternative system, and again, one that really privileges the rights of access, the rights of the community over corporations.
One of the things that really silenced some of these debates about structure and ownership that you mentioned in the book was a purge of particular activists who were questioning and driving debates. What happened in this purge? Are you speaking of the purges during the Red Scare?
That's right. I think we are still only today beginning to understand the extent to which the Red Scare really put down this social democratic vision, social democratic challenge to the libertarianism that prevailed. And you saw elements of this in different areas. For example, on the airwaves, you saw a purge of liberal commentators. That was one of the main critiques that drove the media reform movement throughout the 1940s. But more broadly, you saw reformers being stigmatized as supposedly belonging to some sort of socialistic plot. They were dismissed as communist. No matter how reasonable or innocuous the government policy might be in other contexts, it was easily dismissed as being this sort of statist attempt for government to take over the media system. And I think that the Red Scare sort of did the work of advancing this argument that government had no legitimate role to intervene in markets in general, but media markets specifically. And that's really the legacy that we've inherited from these debates in the 1940s.
It sounds a lot like today's Fox News and Rush Limbaugh.
That's right. I think you see that really being pronounced and articulated in those venues. But also when you hear somewhat crazy things like corporations are people, you know, this assumption that private property rights are rights that should be held above all other kinds of liberties. Back in the 40s, this still was not crystallized. I think I'm trying to trace these arguments, these logics back to their origins. And I do think that this is when it's really starting to consolidate this ideological position that now many people just treat as the natural state of things.
So remind us of some of the purges that happened. You mentioned the firing of the Hollywood 10. Who were they?
Oh, well, that's something I just vaguely just touch on in my book. And I think people are more familiar with the Red Scare and its effect on Hollywood, which, you know, there were union battles going on at this time. There were directors who were advancing social justice themes in various films. And so there's this real cultural battle happening in Hollywood, but it was also happening all across the United States at this time through social movement groups and also just social democratic bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. And so, for example, I focus on Clifford Durr, who was an FCC commissioner who was involved in a number of reform initiatives. And he was not only red-baited, but blacklisted and had a very difficult time. He essentially left D.C. because he refused to force his employees to sign the loyalty oaths that were being instituted at this time. He had a very difficult time ever getting a job again after leaving D.C. So I think this Red Scare just demobilized a generation of activists and social democratic reformers and had a tremendous impact on American society and specifically how America's media system developed.
As a history repeats itself lesson, only slightly different, particularly now with the internet, the debate for net neutrality. There's a great big debate about who should control the internet and should it be a free Wild West. And it seems like the same types of arguments occurring. How would you compare them?
So again, today, I feel like we're having another one of these moments where a kind of social contract is being fought over. Basically, the relationships between those who own the communication infrastructures and the FCC and the public, or at least the, I think the public interest is at stake. And you do see a lot of similar rhetoric. In fact, you've even seen things where conservative activists have tried to brand net neutrality as a fairness doctrine for the internet, which is actually not correct at all. It's not a very good parallel, but you do see similar rhetoric being thrown around. And I think we're at one of those critical moments where these policy decisions can determine the trajectory of, in this case, the internet for decades to come. So the stakes could not be higher.
In fact, I think you even called it something like a death blow. How is this a mortal blow if it goes the way of the 1950s?
First of all, in general, if the FCC were to lose regulatory control of broadband, then we would be entirely at the mercy of the monopolies or the duopolies that control, especially our internet services. So, for example, Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon. There's just a handful of corporations that really dominate the internet service market. But in specifically talking about net neutrality, which is just this basic democratic idea that all content online should be treated equally, that your internet service provider shouldn't be able to slow down content or block particular websites. If we were to lose that safeguard, that protection, it would fundamentally change the nature of the internet. So that would have a tremendous impact on our everyday lives, potentially. I think it's both the specific battle of net neutrality is a very important one, but there's also this broader issue about having control over our media infrastructures.
You're concerned also that if they block or privilege certain content, what is it that you think that we would get?
Some people have likened it to creating a cable television model for the internet, where you would have fast and slow lanes, you might have premium content for which you have to pay extra for. It would just change everything. When people hear this, they're generally not in favor of losing net neutrality. In fact, you saw nearly 4 million people write to the FCC, the overwhelming majority, by some estimates, 99% of which were all in favor of net neutrality. And in fact, the decision's expected to come down on February 26th. It's assumed, it's looking now like the FCC really will vote in favor of the public interest and actually pass a strong net neutrality protection. But I would also argue that this really is only the first step to what should be a larger struggle. In many ways, net neutrality is a kind of secondary problem. And the bigger problem is that we're dealing with these massive corporate monopolies who have tremendous market power. And so I think that's something that we really need to focus on.
One of the other debates that you noted that was going on back in the 40s that is parallel today has to do with this idea that the media should be completely self-regulatory. I think you called it the social responsibility model, and that government should keep out. But as you rightly point out, the government has a role at all times. It's just, what is that role? How would you describe this?
You're absolutely right. So it's a fallacy that the government stays out of media. The government is always implicated in media. We can point to so many different examples. It's just that usually it's not in favor or it's not in protection of the public interest. Instead, you have things like giveaways of the public airwaves to basically corporations who have monopolistic use, who are able to make tremendous profits from that public resource. You also have copyright. Despite all the rhetoric you hear of corporations being anti-regulation, that's seen as a good regulation because it often benefits corporations' profit imperatives. So that's one contradiction. But you're right, it really comes down to how should the media be regulated. And I think those are the debates, these power struggles over how our infrastructure, our media infrastructure is governed. That's what was happening in the 40s, and that's what's happening again today, that this self-regulation, this corporate libertarian paradigm is still dominant. And that's something that we will have to change in order to advance meaningful reform.
You have argued that there are some serious dangers to this libertarian approach. We've seen some limitations to the public debate as a result of this. What are some of the other concerns that you have?
Well, there are a number of concrete concerns. I mean, there's always going to be debate about what is the relationship between media content and the media structures. But some things that you can point to that I think are beyond controversy is this idea of the digital divide. And it sounds like something from the 1990s, but even today in the U.S., something like a third or nearly a third of U.S. households lack access to broadband internet services. So that's a major problem. Also, just the overall lack of competition. Again, despite the surface level appearance of having access to all these channels and websites, when you get beyond that surface, it's actually dominated by a relative handful of corporations. So these are the concerns. The last, perhaps the biggest concern, is to the degree that our public media system is impoverished in the United States. We're a global outlier for how little we pay for our public media. And I think that's something that we really need to try to change, to have a public alternative to the commercial media system.
You noted that in the 1940s, the public was much more knowledgeable and engaged than today. Do you see a relationship to media and media content there?
Well, I do, but I would also nuance this idea that it does seem that the public is more engaged around media policy issues in the 1940s. But I would also, again, point to the 4 million people who wrote to the FCC about this wonky-sounding thing called net neutrality. So I think that it's fair to say that even today, the public does engage. If people understand what the stakes are, and if they can see that media policies are being made not just in their name, but also with their consent, I think you can see public engagement, again, in a very significant way. I'm cautiously optimistic that that's still true today.
After the demise of the Fairness Doctrine, we saw the rise of all of these radio programs with shock jock kind of hosts and much more of a strident, one-sided argument on things like Fox News. And there's a bit of a debate now about whether that has contributed to the polarization of the American public and American politicians, or whether that was actually following the polarization that was occurring. Where do you stand in that argument?
I agree that there is a kind of chicken and egg relationship here. It certainly seems to me, impressionistically, there's been a shrilling of political and media discourse. And I think that must be bound up in what's happened with the rise of partisan news outlets, particularly media like right-wing talk radio, for example. I wouldn't feel comfortable to draw a strong causal link. I would agree, though, that these are problems, and whether the Fairness Doctrine is the best way to address that, I tend to think not. I tend to think that even though the Fairness Doctrine was a very admirable attempt and was useful in some ways, that we really should be trying to make these structural changes to try to create public alternatives to the commercial media system.
And what are some of the ways that we can do that? What are some ideas that you have?
Well, in the conclusion of my book, I run through a number of them, but just a couple fairly obvious ones. Again, going back to this idea that we need to fund our public media system in the United States much more adequately than we do today. Today, Americans pay something like $1.50 per year for their public media, and that pales in comparison to citizens in pretty much all other democratic countries. So that's something we need to change. We should try to see more community and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks. This is actually something that President Obama has come out in favor for. We might see some movement in that direction. And also just for the future, journalism, we need to see more nonprofit newspapers and try to create low-profit or non-commercial news media outlets. And this is going to be a struggle, but I think that we need to do it for the sake of democracy.
How to fund the nonprofit models. As you know, this program airs on a whole series of nonprofit radio stations, but they're all struggling and struggling pretty desperately. What do you suggest?
Yes, so that's an important question. And I should note that Pacifica was one of the shining exemplars in terms of structural alternatives that came out of the 40s. But beyond just being dependent on your listeners for support, I think we need to find ways to subsidize media. And for many Americans, this is a difficult pill to swallow. But I think whether we force commercial broadcasters to pay money for their monopolistic use of the public airwaves, whether we try to convert public infrastructure, so for example, post offices and public libraries, to create community media centers. There are also a number of very innovative ideas like tax vouchers, for example, where individuals are able to put a certain amount of money towards the media of their choice. There are ways to do it. It will take the political will for it to happen.
One of the other issues that you discussed was the relationship that could evolve between media and the government, and having government have some sort of a check. And you mentioned the BBC. I couldn't quite tell whether you were advocating for a BBC model or a modified version. But one of the big issues with the BBC was that whenever the country was in conflict, it was strongly controlled by the government. One example was the broadcasting ban on terrorists, so that the Sinn Féin, who were elected members of the parliament, were not allowed to have their voices on the air. How would you prevent something like that if you had some kind of government regulation?
The BBC is certainly not a perfect model, although when I hear about its problems, I kind of think I'd like to have those problems in the United States. But I think that question about keeping safeguards and firewalls between government and public media has to be of the highest priority. Although I think, in fact, there are studies showing this, that British media and public media in general tend to be more adversarial towards those in power than, say, for example, American privately owned commercial newspapers. But I think that your question is spot on. We would have to make sure that any sort of subsidy is ideologically and content neutral. It just cannot be allowed to, it has to be an indirect and very targeted subsidy, and it cannot be allowed to dictate media content.
I just don't know where you draw those lines when you have them, when you get started down that path. And it's a big question. I feel like your arguments are really for democratization of media in some way, which in principle I'm strongly supportive of. And then I stop and I think, democracy has produced the politicians that we have today who have created this media that we both think is inadequate. So it's a quandary. What are your thoughts on this pros and cons of democratization of our media?
Well, I think that oftentimes it gets framed as either big government control of media or big corporation control of media. And there's a third way that we don't hear about often enough, which is this idea of local community control of media. And I think there you really can have democratization of the media. In fact, there was this public interest policy that got removed in the 1980s, along with so many others, like the Fairness Doctrine. It was known as ascertainment. And one of the things that commercial broadcasters had to do in order to hold on to their licenses was to go into local communities and ascertain, what did those communities want to hear covered on the public airwaves? What sort of issues would they like to hear discussed? And so that's just one example, but I think that sort of, that principle of local control is an important one, and one that we really should try to defend and advance in our media policy.
And this idea of public airwaves, where did that actually come from? And what does it mean today?
Well, this slogan that the air belongs to the people, it sounds like just that, a slogan, but it was true in the 1930s and 40s, and it's still very much true today. It's based on this public trustee model, this idea that the broadcasters only lease those airwaves. It is a public resource just as much as public parks are, and that it's assumed that there is a purpose for this public resource. There's also a scarcity issue as well, that not everyone has the means to create to have a radio station, for example. So there is this social contract, and it should be, it is inherently contentious, but we could have inherited a very different media system had these debates gone differently in the 1940s.
What are merit goods?
Yes, an economic term that I discuss in the conclusion of my book. It's very similar to a public good, but this notion that there are things, there are services and systems that a society requires, but that the market will not support. Public education is a great example of that. But I argue in my book that media, that news media in particular, are one such a type of a merit good that produces tremendous positive externalities that the market can never support sufficiently. So we have to create public means to support this, to subsidize it, in other words. And it's straight out of neoclassical economics, but it's something that's just very rarely discussed in the American political discourse today.
This has nothing to do with your book, Clay, but I was just curious about your thoughts on this group Freedom House.
So you're referring to the group that does surveys on like how democratic countries are, and am I correct?
Well, they particularly look at how free the media are, meaning how much control governments have on them for the most part.
That's right. So, I mean, in my view, and of course, it's not something I discuss in my book, but my understanding is that they find that actually subsidized countries have very free, and in other words, countries that subsidize their media systems tend to be very democratic, and that there's actually a correlation there. There are similar studies, actually, as a side note, that demonstrate this, that in fact, countries with strong public media systems tend to have better informed, better engaged citizens around particular issues, especially international issues. So this goes beyond speculation and polemics, and we now actually have empirical evidence to suggest that the public media systems are good for democracy.
Well, Victor Picard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me back on the show, Maria. I really enjoyed it.
Victor Picard is a professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy and co-author of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Kwatema Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.